companies, Global Tellink, the food service companies like Aramark, the private prison companies like Corrections Corporations of America. They're lobbyists who write the laws that ensure long sentences, full prisons, and huge recidivism rates, and our politicians who pass these laws in exchange for campaign contributions in our system of legalized bribery. We are not deceived. We call out the corporations that exploit underpaid and bonded prison labor for their complicity in neo-slavery. Chevron, Bank of America, IBM, Penny, Sears, Walmart, Eddie Bauer, Wendy's, Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson, Motorola, Caterpillar, Microsoft, Texas Instruments, Pierre Cardin, and Target. We say to all those who oppress the poorest and most vulnerable among us that what you do is sinful and evil in the eyes of God.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges speaking at this weekend's Rise Up October. Thousands protested police brutality. 11 people were arrested at the rally. That does it for the show. We're hiring a director of development. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Tune in Wednesday, October 28th, 6 to 7 p.m. for The Underground, hosted by the KABU Youth Collective. This month's theme is horror. We will be playing stories about Five Nights at Freddy's, working at a haunted house, and the scariest stories that have happened to people. Again, that's The Underground, Wednesday, October 28th, 6 to 7 p.m., KBOO Portland.
Tune in to A Jazz World on Wednesday, October 28th from 2 to 4 p.m. to hear Jessica Lori and her ensemble perform live. We'll be speaking with Jessica about her West Coast tour, where she is these days, and hearing live from the Jessica Lori Ensemble. That's A Jazz World, Wednesday, October the 28th from 2 to 4 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Jessica Lori Ensemble, live.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portland Mayor Charlie Hales has announced that he is no longer running for re-election.
More than 60 people were arrested in Chicago this weekend in protests against police brutality.
And the World Health Organization has determined that processed meats are carcinogenic.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, October 26, 2015. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm June Siegel. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales announced today that he will not seek re-election in 2016. According to the mayor, he has a choice between devoting himself to the job he was elected to do or spending his energy on an election campaign. He says that it's impossible to do both. In the statement he issued through his office, Mayor Hales talked about what he sees as his accomplishments so far. But he did not lay out what his priorities for the next 13 months will be, other than to say that he wants to address the growing problem of gang violence in the city, which he says keeps him up at night. But critics have challenged the idea of gang violence being a top priority, since the Portland police are still under court orders from the Justice Department due to their excessive force and profiling. Many Portlanders say that the real crisis in the city is not gang violence, but the severe lack of affordable housing and support for those facing houselessness.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales is seeking almost $600,000 in new funding to hire up to 75 new police officers. The money would be used to hire 11 background investigators whose job would be to screen new police applicants. The mayor announced the plan in response to a wave of shootings this year in the city. Almost 160 shootings this year have been blamed on gangs, a 45% increase over last year. The Portland Police Union has asked for 700 new police officers to be hired, 10 times more than the mayor's initiative, saying that inadequate staffing of the police force is a major cause of the increased gang violence. The police union said that the 700 new police officers were needed to bring Portland compliant with national police staffing benchmarks. Currently, the Portland Police Department has 190 fewer police officers than it did 15 years ago.
66 people were arrested on Saturday in Chicago for protesting at the annual convention of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke to Joe Osbacher of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression to learn more.
On Saturday, about 100 young people blockaded the entrance to the convention of the International Association of Chiefs of Police to confront the 15,000 cops in attendance for their crimes against the oppressed here and internationally. 66 were arrested after disrupting the convention for hours. Even Chicago's superintendent of police, Gary McCarthy, had to leave the McCormick Center to come out to assess the damage the protest was doing to the image of the convention he was hosting. 500 people marched from Chicago police headquarters a mile and a half away to support the lockdown that was taking place. The march also served as a diversion for the media and some of the attention of the police. The marchers and those arrested were mostly Black, Latino, and immigrant youth coming from those communities where the police, you know, are an occupying army, as they are in all the cities in the U.S., now and, you know, since the police forces in this country were created. At the rally before the march, survivors and family members of victims of police crimes spoke, including Mark Clements, who was tortured into a false confession as a young man and spent over 20 years in prison. Dorothy Holmes, the mother of a young man named Ronnie Johnson, who was shot in the back by a police officer in October. She's still demanding to have the dash cam video released to her family. The march was united around the demands for an end to police crimes and for democratic community control over the police. The main call by speakers was for an elected Civilian Police Accountability Council, which is a specific movement that has emerged in Chicago over the past year. And the movement that emerged nationally over this past year after the rebellion in Ferguson, Missouri, is winning broad public support. However, the police force in the U.S. has impunity. Over and over again, racist cops murder African-American and Latino citizens and residents of our cities, and over again, the cops do not go to prison. Many of the elected officials and political candidates are talking about accountability for the police, but the movement for justice is demanding that killer cops go to prison now. To achieve this requires that the community win control, wrest control over the police. The protesters that sat down and chained themselves together were organized by the Black Youth Project 100. It's a group here in Chicago, and I think it's national as well. A number of other groups organized communities against deportations, We Charge Genocide, also in Chicago, the march was also joined by a contingent from the U.S. Palestinian Community Network. Mohammed Sankari talked about the Israeli Defense Force, which is present at this conference, training the Chicago Police Department, as well as providing training to the police departments in Ferguson, Missouri, and other cities. One of the chants in the march was occupation is a crime from Ferguson to Palestine. And the Palestinians in the march carried the banner of their beloved community icon, Resmia Oda, who's basically being persecuted by the U.S. government for her activism in defense of the Palestinian movement here and in Palestine. So I'll just say it was really a great march. And as we came up Martin Luther King Drive, a burst of joyful noise came from the crowd as we encountered the first 25 young people chained together, blocking the entrance to the convention. And they had a red, black, and green flag flying high overhead, the flag of the Black Liberation Movement. It was really an inspiration.
Now, of course, Days of Action Against Police Brutality were this weekend, the hashtag Rise Up October. Do you know anything about some of the other protests that happened, say, in Cleveland or other cities around?
Yes, we know that there was, a march in New York City as well, and Cleveland, and I saw notices online for other cities, but I was my attention was towards the pavement here, as I was one of the marshals for the march, and so I've seen some videos on the internet, but I believe that the point to all of these marches is that the unstoppable force is meeting the unmovable object. The movement against police crimes for justice is continuing and refuses to stop demanding justice, and yet no justice is forthcoming. This is leading to both bigger protests, more militant confrontations like we had in Chicago, but it's also leading to politicization, as we have seen in Chicago with this movement. In fact, the largest march in Chicago since Ferguson was in August, when 3,000 people marched to demand that the law be changed to take control of the police out of the hands of the mayor and to establish an elected civilian police accountability council here.
A lot of stuff happening. Joe, how can people find out more and keep up with events? Where can people look?
Well, for Chicago, you can go to stoppolicecrimes.com. And there we keep a running calendar of events in the Chicago movement.
Again, I've been speaking with Joe Osbaker. He's a union leader in Chicago and a part of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Joe, it's good talking to you, my friend. Thank you so much.
All right, Doug, and nice to hear from you again, my college roommate. Take care.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Oregon ranks fifth amongst the 10 least tax-friendly states, according to personal finance and business forecasting publisher Kiplinger. Although Oregon doesn't tax Social Security benefits, the state's top income tax rate ranks especially high. The top rate of 9.9% is applied to taxable income over $125,000, and most other retirement income is taxed at the top income tax rate. The upside of retiring in Oregon is that there's no sales tax, there's a deduction of federal income taxes on the state return, and the state offers a retirement income tax credit and a senior citizen property tax deferral program. Coming before Oregon, at least tax-friendly states, are Vermont in first place, then Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Minnesota. For anyone rethinking their retirement in Oregon, Alaska is considered the most tax-friendly state, followed by Wyoming, Nevada, Mississippi, and Georgia.
10 activists were arrested in Denver Saturday night while setting up a tiny home village to be managed and occupied by houseless people. The activists were arrested for trespassing by a force of about 70 officers, including SWAT units from the Denver Police and Sheriff's Departments, under orders from Mayor Michael Hancock. The officers then destroyed and removed several of the tiny homes from the site, which is located at Denver Sustainability Park. The group Denver Homeless Out Loud, made up of houseless people and supporters, has been trying to find a location for the tiny house village for over a year. But due to zoning and code constraints, they have not been able to find a legal place to construct the houses. They said their main goal is to provide safe and sustainable housing for members of Denver's houseless community. On Saturday morning, the group brought the houses they had been building onto the Sustainability Park site. That afternoon, the group was visited by a representative of the Denver Housing Authority, as well as by the developer for the site. By 9 p.m., the officers had made the arrests and destroyed and carted away the tiny houses. A police spokesman said officers gave several orders to disperse before making the arrests. He also said that officers gave back structures that could be returned, which was disputed by the activists. All but one of the arrested activists has been released after posting bail of $100 each. For more information, you can go to the Denver Homeless Out Loud page on Facebook.
Oregon's largest union federation, the AFL-CIO, held a convention in Seaside this past weekend. The union represents over 100,000 workers in Oregon. KBOO labor reporter Jamie Partridge spoke with several people attending the convention about the recent endorsement of a $15 minimum wage ballot initiative and other issues faced by union workers in Oregon.
I'm here talking with Amanda Hill of the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, who works at Kaiser, and she was at the mic at the Oregon AFL-CIO convention in favor of the $15 minimum wage initiative. Amanda, tell us why you support the $15 minimum wage initiative.
I have a daughter in college who's going to have to pay back a lot of student loans, and if she doesn't make at least $15 an hour, she's not going to be able to do that. I'm not ready for her to come back home and live with me.
Tell us what you said at the microphone.
Well, basically, I said that, using the calculator, the family budget calculator that the Economic Policy Institute put out, in order for us to survive on $13.50, we're either going to have to move to Oklahoma, Tennessee, Minnesota, or Nebraska, because in the state of Oregon, you need at least $14.18. So, you know, raising the wage to $15 would at least give us the chance to save for our retirement, help fund college, and prepare for any emergency that might show up.
All right. Thank you, Amanda Hill. And I've got Tina Turner-Morfitt here with me from AFSCME, Council 75 and the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Tina, you spoke at the mic in support of the $15 minimum wage ballot initiative. Tell us about what you said.
Well, basically what I said right now, while the unions are out trying to coalesce with the communities, trying to convince community people that unions are for them, what I said to the delegates today is that we have to be true to that. We can't go and bargain a $15 minimum wage for our members, but then do something less for the community who are non-union workers. If we want to win folks over, we have to do it in good deeds, and a good deed is to fight for a minimum wage of $15. We can't have it both ways.
So there was quite a bit of debate here about the difference between the $13.50 ballot initiative and the $15 ballot initiative. How do you feel about the outcome of the vote here?
Well, you know, I'm really encouraged by the vote, but again, a lot will depend on what happens from this point forward. We have some very dedicated individuals out there who are grass union workers, and they are out there really trying to move this issue, and that's the only reason the issue is still alive. And so I think if we have our sister unions get out there and start supporting them by giving them funds, by encouraging our members to get out there in front of 15 now, then I think we'll demonstrate to the public that we're not just talking out of both sides of our mouth. I mean, they see what's happening on TV. They see when we're able to negotiate a $15 minimum wage for union workers who are already represented. But if they hear us, if we go out there and we fight for something less, like $13.50 for them, then they're going to say, why aren't I good enough?
Thank you very much, Tina Turner-Morfitt of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. All right, we're talking with Ann McDonald, who's a delegate here at the Oregon AFL-CIO Convention for Laborers Local 483, and you are at the microphone in favor of the $15 minimum wage ballot initiative. Why don't you tell us what you said?
Yes. Well, there were two initiatives, one to support 15 and one to support raising the minimum wage, just kind of generally. And Jamie, when you moved to amend that resolution to specifically add 15, I moved to support that amendment. Not because I'm against, quote unquote, a significant increase in Oregon's minimum wage, but because I know resources are finite and I think those resources should be focused on winning 15. I've been a proud member of 483 since 2 years ago when I helped organize the food service workers at the Oregon Zoo. While we were organizing, my dad, back in Arkansas, warned me not to trust the unions. He said they'd make a bunch of empty promises, then just collect my dues. I told my dad he was wrong, that the union never made us any promises. Our field organizer only promised that they'd fight like hell to help us get a fair contract. He said we could only win what we were willing to fight for. After enough of us signed a petition, I was really impressed when our bargaining team put 15 on the table for a bunch of temporary workers. It felt like we were joining a national movement. 15 had just won in Seattle and was making headlines nationwide. We didn't get 15 at the zoo because there had been too much turnover in the year since the organizing drive, too many layoffs, and too many new people who didn't know anything about unions or so-called right-to-work legislations or Friedrichs versus California Teacher Association, any of it. I hadn't heard about that before I joined the Zoolidarity campaign. When we won our first contract last year, many of us got our first raises in 4 years. I went from 11.28 to 13.10. I was glad for the raise and everything we got, but it wasn't enough to live on. I'm a college graduate, paying back loans, single with no kids, sharing a house with a few other people, and still struggling to get by. My savings is spent every time my car breaks down. Aside from Goodwill, I'm rarely spending any money in my local businesses. And I can't afford to fly home once a year to visit my family. And it's not because I'm uneducated or unwilling to work hard. This year, I used up all of my temporary hours working as a gardener at the zoo. The stress was half that of a restaurant lead, but the pay started at almost $20 an hour. Finally, I could pay for the basic living expenses in life. I could pay off my credit card, and I really start paying down my student loans. Importantly, I could set aside enough in savings to soften the blow of my eventual layoff. And now, for the first time, I'm in this funny position where I can collect as much in unemployment as I could working part-time at my old wages. So I'm here today because I still believe in those temporary, seasonal, part-time contingent workers at the zoo, at Portland Parks and Rec, everywhere. I know they deserve better pay, but more importantly, I know they need to believe in themselves, to feel empowered, and to be inspired.
Those were workers at this weekend's AFL-CIO convention in Oregon, speaking with KBOO's Jamie Partridge.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The UAW's GM Council votes Wednesday on whether to send a tentative labor contract agreement to rank and file workers for their ratification. Details of the deal will be released after that vote. The UAW reached a tentative new labor contract agreement with GM just minutes before the old contract expired at midnight Sunday. The UAW says significant gains in job security protections were secured. UAW President Dennis Williams says the agreement will present stable, long-term, significant wage gains and job security commitments to UAW members now and in the future. A Los Angeles and Long Beach port truckers' strike Monday had tremendous impact, shutting down terminal after terminal. PAC-9 drivers entered the 15th week of their strike over misclassification as independent contractors, and truckers struck XPO Logistics for the first time. They are fed up with wage theft, companies deducting large amounts from trucker paychecks for business expenses because the workers are misclassified as contractors rather than employees. Barb Maynard handles press communications for the striking truckers. She described what happened Monday.
This week, the Teamsters are out here in California to support those workers, and it's notched up to the highest level of intensity that it has been. So what's happening is that marine terminal after marine terminal today is telling these companies, if there's a strike, you can't do business here. So they're getting shut out of terminal after terminal today, which is having a tremendous impact.
Teamsters President Jim Hoffa is at the ports for the first time supporting the strikers. Maynard says he'll have major announcements to make about the worker struggle at the ports. I asked her if that included warehouse workers serving the ports who have been also organizing to improve wages and working conditions.
The warehouse is the next stop in the supply chain, and there are some issues that we're starting to see there, and all I can say is stay tuned for the press conference, and I think you'll hear an interesting answer to that question.
According to the Social Security Administration, 51% of American workers made less than $30,000 a year in 2014. The Economic Policy Institute says in 2015, a family of four needs a median income of $63,741 in the U.S. to secure an adequate but modest living standard. Yet 71% of U.S. workers make less than $50,000 a year. These startling numbers underscore the value of the Fight for 15 movement to raise wages at the lower end of the U.S. economy, and the wage numbers offer more concrete proof of the erosion of America's middle class.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Mimi Gurman of No Nukes Northwest about plans to ship nuclear waste across Oregon and other states to Yucca Mountain in Nevada. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6. They'll have a live interview with Martha Grevitt about fighting back against two-tier wages, the auto workers' Chrysler contract. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, when we'll hear With You on the Journey, Families of People in Prison Tell Their Stories, a performance of monologues written by family members of people in prison. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, areas of fog after midnight, otherwise partly cloudy, low around 47. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 63 and a 30% chance of rain after midnight. Today in history, in 1911, the Queen of Gospel, Mahalia Jackson, was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, and in 2001, President George W. Bush signed the USA Patriot Act, resulting in unprecedented levels of government surveillance, control over information, and other abuses. The quote of the day is from Mahalia Jackson, who said, "It's easy to be independent when you've got money, but to be independent when you haven't got a thing, that's the Lord's test."
Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In today's so-called democratic election process, big money doesn't talk. It roars, usually drowning out the people's voice. Bizarrely, the Supreme Court decreed in its 2010 Citizens United ruling that money is a form of free speech. Thus declared, the learned justices, people and corporations are henceforth allowed to spend unlimited sums of their money to speak in election campaigns. But wait, if political speech is measured by money, then by definition, speech is not free. It can be bought, thereby giving the most speech to the few with the most money. That's plutocracy, not democracy. Sure enough, in the first 6 months of this presidential election cycle, more than half of the record-setting $300 million given to the various candidates came from only 358 mega-rich families and the corporations they control. The top 158 of them total $176 million in political spending, meaning that, on average, each one of them bought more than $1 million worth of free speech. Nearly all of their money is backing Republican presidential hopefuls who promise, 1, to cut taxes on the rich, 2, cut regulations that protect us from corporate pollution and other abuses of the common good, and 3, to cut Social Security, food stamps, and other safety net programs that we unrich people need. The great majority of Americans adamantly oppose all of those cuts, but none of us has $1 million we can spend to buy an equivalent amount of political speech. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's not just some good public programs that are endangered by the court's ridiculous ruling. but democracy itself. That's why a new poll by Bloomberg Politics found that 78% of the American people, including 80% of Republicans, want to overturn Citizens United. To help, go to freespeechforpeople.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
A water main break on Sunday compromised the safety of the water in the town of Corbett, Oregon. The Corbett Water District called homes to notify them of the break and tell them about the boil water notice. Only those with homes affected by the break received a call. If you didn't receive one, then your home is in the clear. Those under the notice will have to boil any water used for drinking, cooking, or washing food. The district hopes they'll be able to announce by tomorrow if it's safe to stop boiling the water.
The largest bottled water company in the world, PepsiCo, will add to the label of its Aquafina water brand the fact that the water inside is actually tap water. Aquafina, like the Dasani brand water owned by Coca-Cola Company, sources its water from municipal water supplies, mainly in drought-stricken California. Consumer advocates and environmental groups have pointed out this fact for years. In 2007, Accountability International launched a successful campaign to force the company to reveal the source of their water. At the time, the company agreed to change its label to no longer show snow-capped mountains. But now, PepsiCo has agreed to go further and add to its label the acronym PWS, which stands for Public Water Source. According to a PepsiCo spokesperson, it is reasonable to add this information to its label so people can understand that they are paying a premium for water that is essentially the same as what flows out of their tap. A Business Insider report featuring a market analysis of bottled water found that the amount paid for a gallon of bottled water is 300 times the amount paid for tap water. For single-serve plastic bottles, the ratio is even higher. The American Water Works Association estimates that people who buy single-serve 16-ounce plastic bottles of water are paying 2,000 times the amount they would pay for tap water. And what they are paying for is, in most cases, tap water.
The Catholic Church has called on the UN to set goals for complete decarbonization by 2050 and to formalize a legally binding agreement to limit the increase of global temperature. UN negotiators will be convening in Paris at the end of November to discuss this matter. The Vatican announced the statement today, which was signed by Catholic officials from five continents. It links climate change to social justice and holds the richer nations responsible for global warming, implying they have a debt to pay to the poorer countries, which suffer the consequences of climate change more severely. The statement pressed for each country to recognize, quote, common but differentiated responsibilities, unquote, and called for an end to the era of fossil fuels and support for alternative energy sources. The Church itself has not endorsed any campaign to divest from fossil fuel investments, though it has previously suggested that it would examine the idea. The appeal states that disagreement must put the common good ahead of national interests.
The World Health Organization, or WHO, has published a new assessment of the carcinogenicity of red meat and processed meats. Processed meats have been assessed as a Group 1 carcinogen, which places them in the same category as tobacco smoking and alcohol. The WHO noted in their analysis that the risk from tobacco use is much greater, noting that the assessment describes the strength of the scientific evidence, not the level of risk. Red meat was assessed as Group 2A, which means that it is probably carcinogenic to humans. The review, which was published online today by the prestigious journal The Lancet, was conducted by the WHO's International Agency for Research on Cancer and included 22 researchers from 10 different countries. The review found that consuming 50 grams of processed meat daily increases the risk of developing colorectal cancer by 18%. They also found that consuming 100 grams of red meat daily increases the risk of developing colorectal cancer by 17%. The processed meat includes any meat that has been transformed through salting, curing, fermentation, smoking, or other processes to enhance flavor or improve preservation. Bacon, ham, pastrami, corned beef, hot dogs, hamburgers, and processed turkey are all included, along with many other types of meat.
New research has revealed that childhood cancer rates have skyrocketed in Japan's Fukushima Prefecture. A journal article published earlier this month estimates there has been a 30-fold increase in childhood thyroid cancer rates in Fukushima, near the nuclear power plant that melted down during the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. Some are skeptical about the reported increase and attribute the rise to greater cancer screening. However, the researchers say that the magnitude of the increase is too large to be explained that way. The researchers say that there were 25 new cases of childhood thyroid cancer diagnosed last year alone, and more than 135 since 2012. The average number of childhood thyroid cancer cases in Fukushima Prefecture before the nuclear meltdown was fewer than 5 per year. The Japanese government recently awarded compensation to one worker from the Fukushima plant who was diagnosed with leukemia, though the health ministry still maintains that a definitive connection has not been established. 7 other workers at the site applied for compensation after being diagnosed with cancer, of which 3 have been denied, 1 has been withdrawn, and the remaining 3 are still pending.
3 anti-austerity political parties in Portugal have banded together to form a majority in the Portuguese parliament. Elections held October 4th left the previous governing party, the pro-austerity right-wing PAF party, short of the majority needed to govern. Portugal's Socialist Party, the Left Bloc, and their Communist Party have formed a coalition government to end austerity measures, which have raised taxes and cut spending on public employees' salaries, education, and health care, and has left Portugal with rising debt levels and low economic growth. Traditionally, the newly elected majority coalition names the new prime minister, but the outgoing conservative president Cavaco Silva reappointed the current conservative prime minister to another 4-year term. Silva, a pro-austerity conservative, stated that a stable government that complied with Eurozone rules and that maintained the confidence of international lenders, investors, and financial markets was absolutely crucial to the financing of Portugal's economy. The action has created a potential constitutional crisis in Portugal. Many experts believe the outgoing Conservative Party, although short of a majority, will be able to block effective anti-austerity actions by the new ruling majority coalition. The new left coalition is asking for a no-confidence vote in an effort for new elections to expand their majority against the Conservative PAF party. If a no-confidence vote is approved, the Portuguese government will enter lame duck status and uncertainty over parliamentary powers will remain until new elections have been held. If that happens, it would effectively keep austerity programs in place until new elections are held.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a major earthquake hit the northeastern part of the country today, resulting in over 200 confirmed deaths. The earthquake measured 7.5 on the Richter scale and affected Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the autonomous tribal region between the two nations. At least 4,000 homes were destroyed or severely damaged by the quake. Officials say the death toll is likely to rise as rescue teams head to the affected regions to assess the damage and help survivors. In other news from Afghanistan on Saturday, Afghan National Security Forces seized control of the Garamach district in the northern Faryab province of the country. Taliban fighters captured the district after launching coordinated attacks nearly a week ago. In Great Britain today, police launched an investigation into the British military for the alleged abuse of more than 100 Afghan civilians during the 8 years that British troops were in Afghanistan. Britain pulled all of its troops from the operation last year. The new Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, made it one of his first actions in office to call President Obama and tell him that Canada will be withdrawing all of its troops from Afghanistan as well.
Over the last week, Russia has continued to bomb rebel positions in Syria and provide air cover for the Syrian army in their battle to retake Aleppo, Syria's largest city, which has been controlled by rebel forces since 2012. Russia has also announced a new military alliance with Jordan to go along with the previous agreements between Russia, Iran, Syria, and Iraq. The new agreements bring together previous regional adversaries and changes the balance of power in the region, decreasing Saudi Arabia's influence. Earlier this month, the Saudi government announced agreements to buy $11 billion in weapons from the United States and $10 billion in weapons from France. In other Mideast news, new Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has asked Russia to provide the country with weapons and helicopter gunships to help combat the resurgent Taliban, who have recently recaptured large areas of Afghanistan. Russian diplomats stated that they would consider the request but ruled out sending troops back into Afghanistan. The United States and NATO still have more than 13,000 troops in Afghanistan.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, October 26, 2015. Three killed and at least 40 others injured as clashes continue all over the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem and Gaza. The stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Monday morning a young Palestinian man at the Beit Ayun Junction, north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Israeli media sources said that the Palestinian was shot dead after stabbing a soldier. The slain Palestinian, Raad Jaradat, 22, from Sa'ir town, is a student at Al-Quds Open University. He suffered multiple gunshot injuries and was left to bleed to death, eyewitnesses said. On Monday afternoon, two Palestinian young men were killed in two separate attacks in Hebron and nearby Sa'ir town. Saeed Al-Atrash, 19, was killed by Israeli soldiers in Hebron Old City near the Ibrahimi Mosque. According to eyewitnesses, Saeed was walking home when soldiers operating a checkpoint ordered him to show them his ID card. As soon as he tried to get it out, Israeli troops shot him, then left him to bleed to death. Meanwhile, Iyad Jaradat, 19, was killed during clashes with invading Israeli troops in the southern entrance of Hebron City. According to Palestinian sources, Iyad was shot in the head and was moved to Hebron Hospital for treatment but died of his wounds. The Palestinian Health Ministry said that 61, including 14 children, Palestinians, have been killed by Israeli fire since the beginning of the month. 43 of them have been killed in the occupied West Bank and occupied Jerusalem, 17 in the Gaza Strip, including a pregnant woman and her 2-year-old child, and one in Hora in the Negev. Moreover, 2,120 have been injured by Israeli army gunfire since October, including 820 with live gunfire and more than 900 by rubber-coated steel bullets. On Monday, clashes between local youth and invading Israeli troops were reported in Bethlehem and Hebron City's southern West Bank, in addition to Nablus and Ramallah in northern and central West Bank. Moreover, in Jerusalem, clashes were reported in the Old City part, Isawiya town, and in Abu Dis. Palestinian sources said that at least 40 Palestinians were injured by Israeli gunfire and tear gas during clashes on Monday. Early on Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers have kidnapped at least 13 Palestinians from their homes in occupied East Jerusalem, Nablus, Jenin, and Hebron, while many students and residents have been injured in Hebron. Later on Monday morning, paramilitary settlers attacked homes and stores in Nablus and assaulted olive pickers. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, October 26, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur, Ken Jones, and Callie McHale. Special thanks to Jamie Partridge. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm June Siegel.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with special guests tomorrow, Abe Uris and Joe Proctor. At 9, Alternative Radio features a talk from the archives by the late scholar Edward Said on culture and imperialism. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 11, on stage and studio, host Dee Mae Roberts talks with members of Pass and Art Theater about Tommy J and Sally, their explosive show on race dialogue, and playwright Wayne Harrell talks about the world premiere of his Oregon history play, Rem's Run, at Coho Productions. At 11:30, on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Blake Shell of The Art Gym about their current show, Carte's Uchi, an opera for one. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for this community radio station. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for an interview about new plans to ship radioactive waste through Oregon.